past 30 years. An estimate suggests that over 33 million people are affected by the tragedy. The future of those who are displaced are in limbo, as nobody knows how and where they will rebuild their lives. Nasir Kazmi, Nushera district of northwestern Pakistan.
Afghan women have been struggling for their rights under the Taliban rule. Recently, they have launched this cultural spot under the name of Women's Library.
There are more than 2,000 books in this library. Women and girls can borrow books or enjoy reading them here.
Meanwhile, the founders of the library say this place offers plenty more than just books.
Our aim for setting up this library is to provide teenage girls with a place to study, communicate, and receive an education. Our second goal is to provide a cultural spot for those women who have lost their jobs and have nothing to do. You know that today many Afghan women are literate and don't accept forced isolation at their homes.
Mitra Kakar, a student of 11th grade, was banned from attending her school when the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in August last year. She visits such places to study books, practice drawing, and hang out with friends.
It has been almost a year since we were left out of school. When the Taliban came to power, we were told not to attend our classes. Since then, I have been going through tough times, but I never quit receiving my education. I got an English class and started learning drawings. I also love books and libraries like this. I just hope our school reopens and I can make it to the university. I want to study fine arts.
This place is also becoming a stage for women to speak out. One of the women rights activists here told us that the Afghan women are facing a rollback on their rights since the Taliban's return to power.
If we look through history, Afghanistan has had many prominent, creative, and leading women in different arenas. But since we live under the Taliban rule, it looks like this chain is unfortunately being broken, with women being sidelined or disappearing from active social life. We will keep raising our voices and defend our rights. Neither Islam nor Afghan culture has barred women from getting an education or going to work.
Afghan women rights activists also call on the global community to take serious and practical steps for women rights in Afghanistan. They say that merely condemnations can't relieve their pain, but the international community needs to come forward to press the Taliban to change their stance and uphold the rights of women and girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Rights groups have condemned the death of a 6-year-old Palestinian boy, Farouk Abu Najah, who died last week in Gaza after Israel denied him an exit permit to travel to Al-Quds for urgent medical care. 4 patients, including 3 children, have died so far this year because of the inhumane Israeli practice. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished territory can be a stressful and unpredictable process.
Israel is fully responsible for the death of the child, according to the 4th Geneva Convention. This case is yet another example of Israel's continuous violation of international humanitarian law and human rights law. Denying access to necessary medical care for a child is unwarranted and grave.
We met with the family of Farouk Abu Najah in the southern Gaza Strip, town of Khan Yunis.
When Farouk was born, he was a healthy child, but at the age of 3, he started showing signs of sickness and weakness. His health started to deteriorate, and he was diagnosed with cerebral atrophy. Doctors in Gaza referred him to a hospital in Al-Quds. We applied for an Israeli permit twice, but we were told that his care is under security review. Israel killed my son. Farouk died Wednesday night while waiting for the permit.
Over 1,000 Palestinian patients have lost their lives in the Gaza Strip since 2007. The large number of deaths highlights the lethal impact of Israel's crippling blockade on nearly 2 million Palestinians living in the coastal enclave.
The crippling Israeli blockade and the arbitrary restriction have battered the health sector in Gaza. Hospitals suffer from acute shortage of essential drugs and medical devices and insufficient number of specialized health professionals. Local hospitals are unable to treat many serious diseases, and so raising the number of patients referred for treatment abroad.
Hospitals in the Gaza Strip lack many essential drugs they need to treat patients suffering from severe illnesses. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many patients is likely to further deteriorate.
The Israeli blockade has had a devastating impact on the health and the well-being of people in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Hundreds of Palestinian patients have already lost their lives in recent years in the besieged enclave due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Over 16 months of on-and-off discussions over the revival of the JCPOA appear to be nearing an end, with Tehran reviewing the U.S. response to its amendments on a recent EU draft proposal aimed at reviving the accord. The negotiations started after U.S. President Joe Biden took power on a pledge to correct the mistakes of his predecessor, Donald Trump. That's the man who unilaterally abandoned JCPOA in 2018 and launched a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. President Ebrahim Raisi has now reiterated Iran's conditions for an agreement. They include the settlement of safeguards issues between Iran and the UN nuclear agency.
What have been raised are first assuring guarantees. Second, the verification of the sanctions removal in an objective and practical manner. Third, the removal of sanctions in a meaningful and sustainable way. And fourth, an end to what I call political accusations regarding safeguard issues.
Raisi argued that it's pointless to restore the deal without putting an end to those safeguards accusations. He was referring to the IAEA recently asking Iran to provide explanations for what it called traces of enriched uranium at some of its undeclared sites. Tehran says these are baseless accusations coming from Israel. In his presser, Raisi was asked to comment on Israel's recent threats that it won't be bound by a JCPOA revival agreement and it will do everything to prevent Iran from attaining a nuclear capability. The president said the regime can never hinder Iran's nuclear progress.
The Zionist regime's threats against Iran have led to nowhere. The assassination of Iran's nuclear scientists was meant to stop Iran's progress in the nuclear field, but we were not stopped. Many acts of sabotage and seditions were aimed at stopping us, but we were not stopped. And no measure by the Zionist regime and the arrogant powers will stop Iran from its right to obtain nuclear energy.
Deal or no deal, Iran appears set to resolve its sanctions problems once and for all. Raisi says Tehran pursues efforts to nullify the sanctions concurrent with its efforts to get the sanctions removed. He cited a huge boost in Iran's exports since his government was formed last year, pointing to a five-fold increase in Iran's trade with regional countries.
The final act of terror by the U.S. before ending its 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was targeting a civilian car with a missile and killing 10 members of a family last year. 2-year-old Somaya was the youngest and 6 other victims were under 18. 3 adults were also among the fatalities. This deadly strike took place by the U.S. forces amid their evacuation following the Taliban's return to power.
We heard a very terrifying sound. We were running like crazy to get there. We saw a car burning in fire. People were killed. There was a lot of smoke and people were screaming. The U.S. said there was ISIS in that house, but later they confessed they were all civilians.
So, were there others killed? Yes.
U.S. officials tried so hard not to utter the word civilians at first, but later they confessed that the strike was a mere mistake, taking the lives of 10 innocent people.
And acknowledge our mistakes.
The last memory from U.S. presence in Afghanistan is the drone strike that killed 7 children. During their presence, the Americans conducted thousands of similar operations, killing countless civilians. They used this attack to turn the media away from their shameful pullout. They do such actions by breaking legal and international standards. This was a war crime, and the perpetrators should have been tried.
According to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, more than 900 civilians have been killed in the U.S. airstrike since 2015 in Afghanistan, and so far, no one has been held accountable. The drone strike that took the lives of 7 children and 3 adults showed once more that the victims of the U.S. missions are mostly innocent civilians. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul.
Italy's energy crisis keeps getting more worrying by the day as wholesale gas prices have surged to skyrocketing levels. Italy, like most of its European neighbors, has reviewed its energy strategy following the start of the war in Ukraine and the sanctions against Russia, Rome's largest gas supplier, accounting for over 40% of imports. In an attempt to diversify its gas supplies, Rome has sealed new deals with Algeria and has planned the construction of new gas infrastructures, a move that includes buying more LNG and setting up new regasification plants.
Italy relies on fossil gas for 40% of its electricity production, with the consequence that electricity costs have gone crazy. Our industrial system relies very much on gas-produced electricity. The risk is that the products of our steelmakers and of our manufacturers will soon be out of the market.
Italy's industrial lobby Confindustria has warned of the risk of widespread company failures if energy prices keep surging this way. Confindustria is calling on the government to create a plan for rationing gas and to provide new subsidies to shield manufacturers. Gas prices have recently climbed to over 320 euros per megawatt hour, three times the price recorded at the beginning of July and about 1,000% more compared to the same period a year ago. Businesses have slammed the rate as unsustainable, while consumer groups have described it as an emergency.
The impact on the average Italian will be dramatic. I expect a profound reshape of our lives and energy future.
In less than a month, Italy will return to the polls, with a large number of electors expected to skip the vote. According to latest polls, 16 million Italians, accounting for 35% of Italy's 51 million voters, will not cast their ballot as, quote, the trust in politician is wearing thin. Max Civili, Rome.
In the outskirts of Srinagar, hundreds of people gathered to attend the annual Imam Hussein conference held each year during the holy month of Muharram. Shia as well as Sunni scholars came together to discuss the importance of unity in Islam, the relevance of the Battle of Karbala, and lessons from Imam Hussein to dwell upon.
Imam Hussein, an exemplary personality, needs no introduction. Organizing such conferences in the current world order helps Muslims understand what role they need to play. Imam Hussein set an example by sacrificing his life and that of his companions. He set an unmatched limit of being steadfast to the mission of Islam. These conferences are important as they help people revive their pledges.
Scholars speaking on the occasion emphasized the role of youth in spreading the teachings of Imam Hussein. The scholars warned people against plot by Islam's enemies.
The current world order is against Islam. It's against peace and justice. Evil plots are being hatched against Muslims to divide them. Muslims must remember one thing. Islam is one religion and we must have strong faith in Islam.
Participants at the conference concluded that the Battle of Karbala is a defining moment in the history of Islam that will continue to inspire people regardless of their religious belief.
According to the organizers of Yom Hussein or the Day of Hussein conference, such events are a reminder for Muslims to follow the path of truth, justice and equality in letter and spirit. And not to forget, the key to greater success of Islam is through unity between Shia and Sunni sects of Islam. Shahane Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. We now present you an article written by David Goldman. The piece is titled, Sino-forming of Global South Passes Point of No Return. China's exports to the largest economies of the global south have nearly doubled from pre-COVID levels to a seasonally adjusted $70 billion in June 2022, from $38 billion in June 2019. Several factors have impelled the surge in Chinese exports, but the most important impulse comes from China's strategic investment in digital and physical infrastructure, ranging from broadband networks in Indonesia and Brazil to power plants in Turkey and railways in Southeast Asia. As Western nations question the benefits of globalization, China has become the world's leading globalizer. What I call China's plan to Sinoform the world in a 2020 book has advanced so far that it is beyond the capacity of the United States and its allies to impede. 500 million people in neighboring countries now depend on Chinese technology for their communications, data processing, and logistics, providing China with a nearly limitless resource of young workers for its industries and an ever-expanding export market. For China, economic outreach to the global south is key to breaking through American efforts to contain China's drive for economic predominance. The influential Observer columnist Chen Feng on 28th of July wrote, China has to solve the problem of generating its own independent growth momentum after breaking through the critical point of the Matthew effect, the economic maxim that rich countries get richer and poor countries get poorer. Chen Feng said, America's comprehensive and unlimited anti-China campaign can slow down China's development at the cost of a greater deceleration of the United States. But China is not only putting in place a dual cycle that is promoting domestic consumption as well as exports, adding China also divides the external export cycle into two sub-cycles, Europe and the United States on the one hand, and the Belt and Road, Asia, Africa, and Latin America on the other. What we observe in the trade data suggests that China's investments are paying off in most of the developing world. Western policymakers have been looking in the wrong direction. China's trade with the global south plus South Korea and Taiwan is now as large as its combined exports to the United States and Europe. This is by far the most important event in the world economy since the rise of China itself. The populations of the developing world are dwindling at a faster rate in high-income Asia than elsewhere. The scarcest resource in the world is young workers who have enough education to enter the world economy. When Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese revolutionary leader, began his reforms in 1979, China's per capita gross domestic product was less than $200, and just 3% of adults had tertiary education. China's message to the countries of the global south is, you can grow like we did. If you let us build your infrastructure, install your digital economy, construct your factories, hire your workers, and sell you our products. In Vietnam, Indonesia, Mexico, Turkey, Brazil, and a dozen other developing countries, political leaders have taken China's offer. The Carnegie Endowment wrote in an 11th of July report on China's success in Indonesia. Many claim that China exports its developmental model and imposes it on other countries. But Chinese players extend their influence by working through local actors and local institutions while adapting and assimilating local and traditional forms, norms and practices. In the case of Indonesia, for example, the Carnegie Report says, on average, Indonesians distrust China and many Chinese firms. Yet, top telecom infrastructure provider Huawei, and a lesser extent, China's second-largest telecommunications equipment maker, ZTE, have successfully positioned themselves as trusted cybersecurity providers to the Indonesian government and the Indonesian nation. This has been no easy feat, given long-held Indonesian animosity towards China. Many Chinese companies have faced protests over concerns they were taking local jobs. Huawei and ZTE have suffered no such fate, nor has there been a broad coalition of Indonesian voices against using Chinese technology in critical telecommunications infrastructure. In short, Indonesians care a lot more about Chinese cement plants than they do about Huawei involvement in fifth-generation networks. Carnegie reports Huawei is training 10,000 Indonesian officials in cybersecurity. China, in effect, is delivering a turnkey digital economy to Indonesia, with everything included from broadband-based stations to training. On 25th of July, Indonesian President Joko Widodo visited Beijing, the first head of state to visit the country since last February's Winter Olympics. The Chinese website Observer commented, on 22nd of July, high-level officials from China and Indonesia held a video conference and agreed on advanced plans for the joint construction of the Belt and Road Initiative and the Global Maritime Fulcrum, and make all-out effort to ensure that the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed rail is completed and open to traffic as scheduled, and continuously deepen cooperation in the regional comprehensive economic corridor. The 145-kilometre rail link between Jakarta and Bandung is a prestige project, but it symbolises China's rising profile in Southeast Asia's largest country. China's burgeoning role in the Indonesian economy does not fit the profile of what American critics call debt-trap diplomacy. On the contrary, higher raw materials prices allow Indonesia to pay cash for Chinese imports. The country has run a current account surplus for the past 2 years. Chinese exports to Mexico now comprise 16% of the country's total and have grown as fast as China's exports to Southeast Asia. Telecommunications is a big contributor. Mexico in 2020 had 77 broadband accounts per 100 people versus just 23 in 2012. In between, Huawei built a mobile broadband network and the cost of service dropped by about three-quarters. As a banker for a Hong Kong boutique, I brought Huawei officials to Mexico and Mexico's ambassador to Huawei headquarters in Shenzhen, China. Huawei explained to the Mexicans that they had a big economy but woefully inadequate broadband. The Huawei officials said, "They let us build you a broadband network and the ecosystem of e-commerce, e-finance and digital technologies that go with it, and you can become rich like China." In fact, Huawei had a published plan for the digital transformation of every country in the world. Many of them are in the advanced stage of implementation. China's investments in Mexico have risen rapidly in the past 2 years. $5.8 billion of China's total $20 billion commitment to the country was disbursed in the past 2 years, in part because Chinese companies are moving facilities out of the United States to its southern neighbor, Mexico. China's investment in Brazil, now the world's largest producer of soybeans, are considerably larger. Luis Augusto de Castro Neves and Tulio Cariello, in a 2022 book, report, as of 2020, Brazil has received more than half of all Chinese investment in Latin America, around $66 billion, with three-fourths of that investment dedicated to the energy sector, and the rest going to agriculture, infrastructure, and other industries. Turkey's imports from China have tripled since 2018. China also is the country's largest export market. The first train to Istanbul from the Chinese city of Xi'an arrived in 2019 on a line built under the Belt and Road Initiative. China's largest transport company, COSCO Shipping, brought a $1 billion controlling stake in Turkey's third-largest container port. China financed Istanbul's new airport with a $6.2 billion loan. Turkey's swap line with China allows it to pay for imports in yuan rather than in US dollars. As the Turkish lira crashed last year and Turkey's dollar reserves fell, the local currency swap line became a critical source of trade financing for Turkey. China's trade with the Global South could shift to national currency in short order. By 2019, China had established $500 billion in local currency swap lines with other countries. According to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, swap lines among Asian central banks are estimated at $470 billion. Financial technology is now available to conduct retail transactions directly between Asian countries. According to the Monetary Authority of Singapore and the Bank of Thailand, in 2021, Singapore and Thailand linked their real-time payment systems, PayNow and PromptPay, enabling customers of participating banks in Singapore and Thailand to transfer funds of up to $1,000 to or 25,000 baht daily across the two countries using just a mobile number. The Sino-forming of the world has far-reaching strategic implications. China's influence in Southeast Asia is growing almost as fast as its trade profile. Indonesia has embraced China's vision of economic development driven by digital infrastructure and managed by Chinese technology providers. The Philippines elected Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos by an unprecedented two-thirds majority, partly on a platform of greater economic cooperation with China. Turkey is now an economic dependency of China, which has sustained its imports despite the collapse of the Turkish lira and rampant inflation in the country.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A strategic failure. That is how a top U.S. general has described the Afghan war, pointing to the Taliban back in power and the U.S. withdrawal from that country. Meanwhile, the Taliban has marked its first year anniversary of foreign and American troops exiting with flags and chants in central Kabul, while residents rejoice that peace has come despite the deteriorating economic situation. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the U.S.'s longest war and why its intervention was a failure, as stated by their own general. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Brian Terrell joins us. He's a political commentator and peace activist who joins us from Malloy, Iowa. Also joining us, Daniel Lazar, author and journalist, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'll start first with you, Brian Terrell. When you have a U.S. general, and it's a sobering assessment, say, quote, outcomes in a war like this, an outcome that is a strategic failure, the enemy is in charge in Kabul, there's no way else to describe that, that the outcome is a cumulative effect of 20 years, not 20 days. The fact that he's saying that, that it is a failure, what does that say about this war altogether?
Well, I would question whether it was a failure or not. The failure... That presupposes that winning the war was ever something that was contemplated or even desired. As Julian Assange said back in 2011, I think, that the purpose of this war was to wash money out of the U.S. and European tax bases through Afghanistan into the hands of the transnational security elite. And as that, it's been very successful. These, billions and billions of dollars have disappeared, but they have not disappeared into thin air. They've gone into some people's pockets. And it's been it's done that quite successfully. And it does not bode well because we're continuing to foment more of these wars. And the money keeps rolling in for Raytheon and Boeing and such.
So who's making off with this money? How does that transpire? Can you give us a short version of how that happens?
Well, the Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, is formerly member of the Board of Directors for Raytheon Technologies. This was a great deal from the beginning for Dick Cheney and his investments during that time. I had the opportunity to visit Afghanistan. I was there seven times from 2009 to 2018. And each visit, I saw the situation deteriorate. My last visits, I would be the only Westerner leaving the airport after deplaning and going through immigration because everybody else was going from getting on a helicopter and going to another armed compound. It was getting more and more dangerous and devolving. During that time, the United States, not the war expenses, but on the so-called reconstruction, spent more money. More money was spent on reconstruction of Afghanistan than the entire Marshall Plan at the end of World War II that rebuilt the cities of Western Europe. And saw nothing of that. The only roads that were paved were between the military bases, and the only housing, was the hospitals were getting worse. I had to visit the hospitals; they were getting, the schools. Everything was getting worse the whole time, every time. And the compounds where the elite lived, the oligarchs lived, they were improved, and the
sure.
So
sure. Let's see what Daniel Lazar thinks about this. Daniel Lazar, you heard our guest there. Lots of money not going for the reconstruction of Afghanistan, billions of dollars. That puts another light on this whole situation. Not that it wasn't known before. Who do you think made out with all this money?
Well, it wasn't billions. It was trillions. It was an astonishing sum. And yes, it went to the arms manufacturers, the contractors, various NGOs, and countless other parasites who who wound up making small fortunes off this entire misadventure. But I would emphasize that it wasn't merely a get-rich scheme. The America completely lost its way. Its imperial doctrine utterly failed after 9/11. And one reason is that America was unable to admit that the country that was most responsible for that attack was Saudi Arabia. Because if America had admitted that, it would have had to essentially break relations with Riyadh and completely reconstruct or rethink its entire military presence in the Persian Gulf region. So rather than do that, America chose to blame everybody else that it possibly could. Instead of Riyadh. I mean, it blamed Iran, it blamed Afghanistan, it blamed Saddam Hussein, it blamed everyone. And the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq were just fantastic misadventures. I mean, just America really went crazy and really behaved in a way that was utterly irrational, even by imperialist standards. And empires often behave quite irrationally. And so the U.S. really blundered into a quagmire. It had no way of winning and never really had thought of even tried to define what meaning might even mean. And so as a result, it ran through trillions, left the country in worse shape than when it arrived, brought nothing but poverty and suffering, and now has left Afghanistan to its own devices while seizing something like $7 billion in Afghan overseas deposits. So it's just a colossal scandal, no matter how you look at it.
Indeed. One of the things there, Brian Terrell, that our guest Daniel Lazar mentioned is the fact that they didn't know what they were doing. I'd like to expand a little bit more on that with you, because the reports that have indicated and have confirmed the fact that senior U.S. officials actually failed to tell the truth when it came to what was happening there and about the performance throughout this 20-year occupation that happened there. They actually made rosy announcements about what was going on there. They were hiding the facts and the evidence that this war had become unwinnable. But they were presenting another side to that story, a false side, that they were successful. This lying that they did was happening for a long time. Why is it then that nothing was done about the prevention of the lies, but more so for them to find a solution to improve what was going on there? Because the occupation continued, even though reports came out that they had lied about it.
Well, there's a long history of this in the Vietnam War. Of course, we have the Pentagon Papers that Daniel Ellsberg released, telling that the rosy story that General Westmoreland and the presidents Nixon and Johnson were portraying were lies. Way back then, and there have been leakers, WikiLeaks and. Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning, people have had the courage to speak up, and what was happening to them is the punishment of the ones who told the truth. Another general who should be mentioned is General Stanley McChrystal, who was under Obama was the head of the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, and he made the mistake of having a telling the truth interview with Rolling Stone magazine. And he said back then that this was unwinnable and that he was for every innocent Afghan who's killed, the United States is creating 10 new enemies. And of course, President Obama got his job. He was demoted. He was fired for telling the truth. So the truth has been out there. The U.S. media has been. Very complicit in trying to silence that truth. This is not something, it's these having these generals today come out as like, who knew we were losing? Who knew that this was a waste? It really is disingenuous. I think this was something that we knew from the beginning, and in the beginning too, from.
Let me come to you, Daniel Lazar. I think we may have lost. I'm sorry, we lost connection with you, Brian Terrell, for a second. This is what's very confusing, Daniel Lazar, and I'd like to find out from you if you have an answer. Back in 2015, Douglas Lute is a 3-star Army general who served in the position of what's called the White House's Afghan war czar during the Bush and Obama administration. This is what he has said. We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan, and this is the part that's really shocking. We didn't know what we were doing. He says, what are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking. I'm trying to really digest that. How do you go into another country and then not know what you're doing there?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. It's very hard to understand. But remember, first of all, that after 9/11, America had to invade someone, and its primary target was Saddam Hussein in Iraq. However, the Democrats thought that was ridiculous because Al Qaeda had a certain presence in Afghanistan, and in fact, its chief Osama bin Laden was actually physically located in Afghanistan. So to oblige the Democrats to satisfy their concerns, the Bush administration invaded Afghanistan. But it really invaded Afghanistan merely to show that it could invade Afghanistan using a very small force and using various allies on the ground to overthrow the regime. And that operation was highly successful, But the next day arrived and America had no idea what to do. It hadn't given any thought as to what it would do with this immense country of 40 million people once it succeeded in toppling the Taliban. So therefore, they spent 20 years dithering, in utter confusion, knowing nothing about the country itself, knowing nothing about what the goal should be, what America was doing there, anything like that. So that's what we saw. And I might add, by the way, that one of the great champions of the Afghan invasion was Joe Biden, who at the time was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a major figure in U.S. foreign policy formulation. And what was Joe Biden's punishment? Obviously, there was no punishment. He was rewarded by being, transported into the White House, where he then was able to preside over this utter defeat that America suffered last August. It's really bonkers.
So many things here that just boggles the mind, Brian Terrell. One of them is something that actually the U.S. wants to boast that it does when it intervenes illegally in some sense into other nations. But many U.S. officials have acknowledged that Afghanistan's, that the U.S. purpose there was to remake it into a modern nation, okay? So that to me gives the notion of nation building in a sense. Now, this is what Obama stated after the U.S.-backed NATO invasion of Libya about his worst mistake. He said, probably failing to plan for the day after, okay? What I think was the right thing to do in intervening in Libya. Did the U.S. think this through in terms of militarily coming in, but then what it is going to do to, in this case, rebuild the nation or to move towards nation building?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that presupposes that's actually what they wanted to do. And I think whatever the motives that someone like Obama or Biden might personally have had, the idea that if you repeat a mistake over and over and over again, repeated in Vietnam, repeated in Libya, repeated in Afghanistan, repeated, Honduras, repeated in, the list could go on and on. It's a sign of a criminal pattern. It's not good, well-intentioned people making mistakes over and over and over again. The same mistakes happened, and again with from the beginning of this, from President Carter starting to arm the Mujahideen. There were always people. There were always experts. there are always people saying, don't do it, don't do it. As we're seeing in Europe now, from 1993, there were people, anybody knowing anything about the situation in Europe saying, NATO cannot expand. We're not going to expand NATO. Even Joe Biden warned in 1993, warned that expanding NATO was going to provoke Russia. And look where we are. It's not a progression of the same mistakes over and over and over again is a pattern of criminality. If these people are, if these are truly mistakes, and perhaps they are, then we're being ruled by and have been ruled for decades by a government that is absolutely incapable, inept, unable to govern itself, much less trying to export itself, the idea that the United States today is trying to rebuild other nations while our own infrastructure is falling apart, while our own education and our roads and everything that makes for a decent life. The life expectancy of Americans is going down for the first time while we're spending more than $1 trillion on extending the life of our nuclear weapons, which are clearly illegal under all these international laws that we're party to. There may be good intentions there, but the good intentions are not. It shows how little good intentions count.
Well, I mean, to even wrap our thoughts around this is so difficult, Daniel Lazar. The U.S. government is cited by a Washington Post report that came out a few years back, in which it interviewed 400 or 500 military personnel. One of the things that it came out with was said that it deliberately misled the public, that it was common, it said, to distort statistics to make it appear that the U.S. was actually winning the war. So you're lying to the American people, you're lying to the world, really, after you spend all this money. But the way of going about lying is what I'm questioning here. When you come and you distort numbers, and you mislead the public in that way, that's incredible, right? And then it's still happening, because after Afghanistan, you know, there are other wars now. I mean, we're looking at somewhat Ukraine, or somewhat for the U.S. to be involved in the Ukraine conflict. What is your impression of the U.S. going about it that way?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct. It really is mind-boggling. But you've got to remember, you know, let's go back to 9/11. The U.S. had invested literally trillions of dollars in militarizing the Persian Gulf and strengthening the Saudi regime. And what it got for its efforts on September 11th, 2001, was death and destruction on an unprecedented scale in Lower Manhattan. So American policies had blown up in its face. Now, in any kind of honest government, that would have meant a massive reanalysis, reconceptualization, rethink of where U.S. Middle East policy was going. But that was the last thing Washington wanted to do or was even capable of doing. So as a result, America engaged in these completely eccentric, willfully absurd actions, whose purpose was to, number one, lie to the American people about the, what had happened on 9/11. Number two, to sort of demonstrate that, to flex its military muscle to show it was still a tough guy. And number three, to knock over some unfriendly regimes in the Middle East, beginning with the Taliban in Afghanistan and then culminating with the Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And by the way, if the war in Iraq had been successful, the U.S. then had a list of something like five other countries it was planning to invade, including Iran. Now, this was complete madness. It was nothing more than a gigantic temper tantrum, and it led to disaster. And it just goes to show how completely broken the American political leadership really is, and political leadership in both parties. I mean, the American government operates in a bubble. It has little understanding of how of the world at large, little understanding of it, of how to conduct itself relative to the world at large, and is just careening out of control, creating disaster wherever it goes. I mean, Afghanistan was a start, but it's not the end by any means.
Well, I was trying to figure out, Brian Terrell, how much money the U.S. is spending on its involvement with the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm going to go out on a limb and ask this question if you think that my thinking here is either correct or completely out of line in a sense. You know, you have this 20-year occupation war that ended, and the fiasco that it was, and even the way it ended was a fiasco. And now that that's ended, we are seeing, about 6 months into the Ukraine conflict, we're seeing how the U.S. Is spending money. Few hundred million dollars a day is one estimate, but if you take a look at the bigger picture, it's billions of dollars. Are we looking at a pattern where there needs to be a war for the U.S. government to flow cash into it? And based on the past, like Afghanistan, there are people who are making out that are profiting from this, hence that war, the term war profiteering, which is coined from the U.S., basically, is showing itself again. Is this a pattern? That we're seeing here?
Well, yes, it is. The United States at this point, we really don't have any other product. We don't have anything to offer. Everything that we have in a, you go in a department store in the United States and everything is made in China, or our clothing comes from Guatemala. It's all, you know, it's the import that we, the export that we have is weapons. And it's the mainstay of our economy. It's we're in we don't have anything else to offer the world right now that anybody wants. I think we're also dealing with climate change and a frantic effort to maintain the control over fossil fuels instead of looking for alternatives. The biggest part of the budget for the Department of Energy for the United States is developing nuclear weapons. It's not looking for renewable alternatives to fossil fuel. It's not looking for independence. It's looking for control of other people's oil.
Okay.
While we build more weapons.
Final question goes to you, Daniel Lazar. The question about the CIA having terrorists on its payroll, where it's, again, this is not new news. You had the Daesh and you had these terrorists and warlords, as they called it, on CIA's payroll because they needed their cooperation. Are we looking at that still continuing today in Afghanistan, in a sense? Because the U.S. says it's pulled out, but it still is involved one way or another. 30 seconds.
Yes, I have no hard information. But I suspect the same thing. I suspect the U.S. still has a hand in Afghanistan. It still has a finger in the pie. I assume that Saudi money is flowing to ISIS. And okay. If that is truly the case, I assume that the CIA knows about it.